This is Track 2 of Lecture 7 of the series Inflation and Price Controls.
So let's assume that we did repeal our controls. The effect would be that the price of domestically produced oil would rise above $7.66 per barrel, its present controlled price. But the effect would also be that the price of imported oil, and therefore the price received by the Arabs, would fall below $13 a barrel. To understand just why, imagine for a moment that the price of domestically produced oil simply rose all the way to $13, the same price as the Arabs now receive. If that happened, the cost of producing oil products would have to be based on an average price of $13 a barrel rather than the present average of $9.80 a barrel. Because if both components in the average of crude oil are $13 a barrel, the average must be $13. The prices of oil products would therefore have to be raised correspondingly. But observe, at such higher prices, the quantity of oil products that could be sold would be less, and therefore the quantity of crude oil that could be sold would also be less. You can't sell as many oil products if their cost has to conform to $13 a barrel instead of $9.80 a barrel. And if you can't sell as many oil products, you don't need as much crude oil. The only way to counteract this loss in sales would be if the prices of oil products did not rise by so much. The only way that that would be possible would be if the average price of crude oil did not rise by so much. But this implies that the price received by the Arabs actually falls, because on a free market, our oil would sell for just as much as theirs, yet we have just seen that their present price of $13 is too high for an average cost base. Our price cannot meet theirs at $13 a barrel. Both must come together at some lower figure. Our oil would sell for just as much as theirs, but at a price that is lower than their present price of $13. Observe further. In order for the same quantity of crude oil to be sold in this country as is presently sold, it would be necessary for the Arabs' price to meet ours at $9.80 a barrel, the present average. Because any higher cost base than $9.80 would require a rise in the price of oil products, which would reduce the quantity of oil products that could be sold, and which would therefore reduce the quantity of crude oil that could be sold in this country. So observe, in order to sell the same quantity of crude oil in this country, we would have to have the same cost base as we now do. But our domestic oil would be more. That implies that our domestic oil and the Arab oil would come together at $9.80. Instead of them selling at $13 and us at $7.66, we'd both be selling at $9.80. Indeed, one may raise the question of why the effect of repeal would not actually be to leave the price of oil products unchanged in the United States and simply reduce the price of Arab crude oil and raise the price of our crude oil to the present average of $9.80. The reason these results would not occur is because oil imports into the United States would diminish. The present price of $13 for imported oil prevails throughout most of the world. The price of imported oil could not fall to $9.80 here while it was any higher elsewhere. What would happen is that as the price of imported oil fell in this country in the direction of $9.80, less of it would be sent here and more of it would be sent to other markets. The result would be that the price of imported oil would settle at some amount above $9.80, say $10.50 or $11 or wherever. And the price of our domestically produced oil would settle at the same point. So the consequence of repeal would be some rise in the average price of crude oil in the United States and some rise in the price of petroleum products in the United States. But please observe that the rise in price to American consumers would be much less than the rise in price to American producers, because much or most of the rise in price received by our oil companies would be financed by a fall in the price received by the Arabs and other foreign suppliers. Furthermore, the rise in domestic prices would be a short-run effect, because oil production in the United States would have become vastly more profitable, and American oil companies would have billions of additional dollars to invest in oil production. Domestic oil production would immediately begin to expand, even from existing wells, because it would pay to exploit them more intensively at higher oil prices. And then, within a year or two, new wells would start to come in. As American production grew, the price of oil would begin to fall. And as a result, oil imports would fall further. Observe, as soon as controls were repealed, America would immediately become less dependent on unreliable foreign supplies by virtue of reducing imports, and would grow still more independent as our own production expanded. All of this could be achieved simply by repealing the existing controls on oil. I refer you back to Lecture 6 for what could be achieved by a more comprehensive program of freedom that would include such things as freeing the natural gas industry and an end to the harassment of energy producers by the ecology movement. Unfortunately, a majority of the present Congress, the 94th Congress, seems more eager to help the Arab oil industry than to promote the best interests of the United States. In the fall of 1975, the Congress actually rolled back the average price of domestically produced crude oil from $8.75 a barrel to the present $7.66 a barrel. In the process, it imposed price controls on a major portion of domestic crude oil production that had been temporarily free of controls. Prior to last fall, so-called new oil, that is, oil produced from wells that began operation after January 1973, was free of controls. This, of course, would have meant the progressive freeing of the oil industry as a larger and larger proportion of oil came to be new oil. The Congress placed new oil under controls by retaining the control on old oil at $5.25 a barrel and requiring that new oil be priced in such a way that the average price of old and new oil together amount to $7.66 a barrel. So we had a control on old oil at 5.25. New oil was uncontrolled. The average was $8.75. Then Congress decided to keep old oil at 5.25 and to control the average of new and old oil together at $7.66. The effect of this legislation was to transfer billions of dollars away from our oil industry and to the Arab oil industry, and to make us even more dependent than before on unreliable foreign imports. The Congress acted in order to reduce the price of gasoline by 2 or 3 cents a gallon, and probably out of a desire to punish the American oil industry. President Ford, who still talks about the goal of energy independence, did not veto the legislation. As matters stand now, our oil industry will become increasingly undermined in the years ahead, while that of the Arabs will continue to prosper at our expense. Observe, the formula by which the price of new oil is controlled actually implies a progressive rollback in the price of new oil as the proportion of new oil in domestic output increases. For example, right now, about half of domestic output is new oil and half is old oil. And since old oil is controlled at 5.25 a barrel, new oil can sell at 10.06 a barrel and still comply with the present requirement that the average price of domestic oil be $7.66. See, if old oil is 5.25 and the average is controlled at $7.66, that implies that new oil, given that it's 50% of output, can be 1006. But as time goes on, there will be proportionately less old oil and proportionately more new oil. When all domestic oil is new oil, for example, it will have to sell at the 766 figure. In the interval, it will have to descend from the present 1006 toward 766. I should mention that the law does allow the Federal Energy Administration, the FEA, to raise the controlled average price by a maximum of 10% a year, so that next year, for example, the controlled average price might be as high as $8.43 a barrel instead of the present $7.66. If the FEA chooses to grant the maximum allowable increases under the formula, it might just about offset the rise in the proportion of new oil. This would mean that the controlled price of new oil could stay more or less where it is now and not actually have to drop. But even assuming the FEA does grant the maximum increases, they will be of little help because inflation will certainly be acting to raise the costs of new oil, while at best the government will merely abstain from further reducing its price. Observe what the government is doing to the oil industry. On the one hand, it has arranged matters so that the price of new oil must automatically be rolled back unless the government chooses to take deliberate action to keep the price where it is now. On the other hand, the government prints money without restriction, so that the costs of finding and producing new oil are sure to rise, and can rise to an unforeseeable extent. Clearly, the government has the oil industry in a vice, and the oil industry is simply not going to invest much money under these conditions. As a result, as our existing wells run dry, they will not be replaced. We will thus have to rely more and more on imports, and the Arabs will be in a position to boost the price of oil higher than ever before. The next subject that I want to discuss this evening is why price controls tend to spread until all prices and wages in the economic system are controlled. That is, why partial price controls lead to universal price controls. Universal price controls existed in the United States in World War II. They also existed very briefly under President Nixon when he imposed a 90-day freeze on all prices and wages in August 1971. They could easily come into existence again in this country, and this time on a long-term basis within the next few years. As we will see next week, universal price controls existed in Nazi Germany, and the equivalent of universal price controls exists in every truly socialist country, such as Soviet Russia, Red China, and the other members of the Communist Bloc. The reason partial controls lead to universal controls is their destructiveness. We have already seen, last week and earlier tonight, how partial controls destroy the industries to which they apply, while causing the uncontrolled industries to flourish. If the government wants to prevent the destruction of the industries it initially brings under controls, it has only three alternatives. It can repeal its controls on those industries, it can subsidize their losses out of the treasury, or it can control the prices that constitute their costs of production. If the government refuses to repeal its initial controls, and if it is unable or unwilling to pay the necessary subsidies, then its only alternative is to extend its price controls to the prices that constitute the costs of the industries concerned. But then the same story repeats itself, and the government finds it must bring under controls the prices that constitute the costs of these industries too, and so on, with a list of controlled prices steadily lengthening. For example, consider the case of the oil industry right now. it is headed for destruction, as we have seen. In order to prevent this, the government can either repeal the present controls on oil or subsidize the oil industry to the extent of billions of dollars a year, or extend its controls to include the prices that constitute the oil industry's costs, such as the price of steel pipeline and the wages of oil field workers. If it controls these prices, then it must go still further. It must extend its price controls not only further backwards, but in every direction. For example, if it controls the price of steel pipeline, then it must extend its controls to all other steel products as well, such as I-beams, steel sheet, steel cans, and so on, as well as to the price of iron ore, coke, the wages of steel workers, and so forth. Because if it does not, the effect of its control on steel pipeline is simply to make that one steel product less profitable than the others, and so to destroy its production. Similarly, if the government controls the wages of oil field workers, it must control wages in other occupations into which the oil field workers might go, or into which potential oil field workers might go. And as soon as it controls wages in these other occupations, it must seek to control wages in all the fields into which these workers in turn might go. Obviously, the government must quickly seek to control all wages because all the different occupations are interconnected. And as the government controls wages and other prices that constitute costs, it is led to extend its controls forward to whatever remaining products may have previously escaped controls, because otherwise the controls on costs would merely serve to make such products more profitable and thereby encourage their production at the expense of the controlled products. In this way, price controls have the potential to spread through the economic system like a cancer traveling through a human body's lymphatic system. All that it takes for this to occur is for controls to reach the point that the government becomes unable or unwilling either to tolerate their effects or to use subsidies to prevent their effects. For example, the effects of the limited controls we have had up to now, such as rent control in New York City, could largely be tolerated by the government because they critically affected only a small minority of people. And to the extent they could not be tolerated, the government was able to some degree to mitigate them with subsidized housing of one kind or another. But the effects of the destruction of the oil industry or the electric utilities will be intolerable to the government, and it may very well lack the will or the ability to subsidize these industries on the vast scale that would be necessary to save them. Hence, these controls may very well turn out to be malignant and bring about universal price controls. The final point that I want to discuss tonight is the fact that universal price controls create universal shortages, in which the shortage of each good compounds the shortage of every other good. Under universal controls, a shortage not only exists of each good, but the excess demand for each good spills over and adds to the excess demand for every other good. As illustration, consider again the case from earlier tonight of the man who wants a television set but cannot find one at the controlled price. If television sets are the only controlled good, he can find his second choice, a new suit perhaps. But now, under universal controls, he is as unlikely to find that as he is his television set. As a result, he must be prepared to settle for his third choice, or indeed for his fourth, fifth, or still lower choice, if it is all that is available to him. Eventually, in fact, he will be willing to settle for any good that is of greater intrinsic utility to him than the otherwise useless paper money. That is, he will be willing to settle for virtually anything at all. Please realize that paper money is of less intrinsic utility than the least valuable good. It does not even make good wallpaper or provide a good fire. The only reason that people do not rush to trade it in for matchsticks or pins or any other intrinsically more useful commodity is that they expect to be able to obtain still more valuable goods for it later on, perhaps later that day, the next week, or whenever. Price controls and shortages undermine this expectation. They destroy the desire to hold money and eventually make people willing to accept virtually anything in exchange for it. Observe, in these conditions, our man's unsatisfied demand for a television set is simultaneously an unsatisfied demand for a new suit and simultaneously an unsatisfied demand for goods of still lower choice. It is an unsatisfied demand for anything and everything. And so it is with the unsatisfied demand of everyone else. Thus it comes about not only that there is an excess demand in the entire economic system, but that the whole of it is poised, ready to strike at whatever goods may be available from any industry. The excess demand facing each industry comes to be not only the unsatisfied demand of those for whom its products are the first choice with the money in question, but also the unsatisfied demand of those for whom its products are the second, third, fourth, and still lower choices. In this way, the excess demand of the whole system comes to exert its pressure against every point in the system. And this excess demand is everywhere further compounded by an enormous hoarding demand. Now, this discussion, I would like you to all realize, is an actual description of conditions in Soviet Russia. In Soviet Russia, there is a shortage of everything. The only exceptions are goods they manage to produce that are of negative utility, such as pots that ruin the taste of food or clothes that shrink out of all proportion to their original size. Apart from such exceptions, everything is chronically in the same state of shortage as gasoline was in this country in early 1974, but worse. A recently published book called The Russians by Hedrick Smith, which I recommend, tells of waiting lines up to a mile long and of one to sign up to buy rugs, a once-a-year event in Moscow, that was comprised of between 10 and 15,000 people lined up four abreast in the winter snow that lasted for two solid days and nights. Smith reports that Russian women normally spend 14 hours a week waiting in line just to buy food. He writes that women carry shopping bags called just-in-case bags, meaning bags for just-in-case they happen to find something worth buying. The briefcases that Russian men are generally seen carrying serve the same purpose. He also reports that people carry around with them the clothing measurements of all their relatives and friends in case they come across something that will be available. I cannot resist quoting one passage because it so eloquently describes the condition of a willingness to buy anything. Quote, "Yet despite such ordeals, the instinctive reaction of a Russian woman when she sees a queue forming is to get in line immediately, even before she knows what is being sold. Queue psychology has a magnetism of its own. Again and again, I have been told by Russians that anyone's normal assumption on seeing people up front hurrying to get in line is that there must be something up there worth lining up for. Never mind what it is, get in line first and ask questions later. You'll find out when you get to the front of the line, or perhaps they'll pass back word before then. A lady lawyer told me she once came upon an enormous line stretching all through the Moskva department store, and when she asked those online what was on sale, quote, they said they didn't know or else snarled at me and told me not to interfere. I walked up 20 or 30 yards asking people and no one knew. finally I gave up asking. End of both quotes. Shortages of this type come to exist whenever universal price controls are in force for any significant period of time. Now, before I conclude tonight's lecture, I would like to anticipate a difficulty that many people have in understanding how excess demand can exist under universal price controls. Many people reason in the following way. The main source of demand for consumers' goods, they say, is incomes, especially wages. But under universal price controls, everybody's wages, interest, dividends, and so on are controlled. Therefore, people ask, how can demand be rising and a problem of excess demand be created? The answer to this question is that excess demand is created by virtue of an expansion in the quantity of money, and that the limitation of incomes is irrelevant. In order to understand this point as clearly as possible, consider again the case of our hypothetical small economy with $10,000 of demand and 1,000 units of supply, and a general price level of $10 per unit. Let's assume that the $10,000 of demand in this economy is the result of the spending of $10,000 of incomes. Let's assume further that when price controls are imposed in this economy, incomes are frozen at a total of $10,000. Nevertheless, demand in this economy can grow progressively more excessive, or at least potential demand, in the following way. Assume that the government decides to spend $1,000 out of newly created money. The price of what the government buys is controlled at $10 a unit. Consequently, the government buys 100 units of the economy's supply. This leaves 900 units of supply for the citizens. Those 900 units are controlled at a price of $10 per unit. That means the most that it is possible for the citizens to spend in buying these 900 units is $9,000. Nevertheless, the citizens want to spend $10,000, their incomes. Clearly, the citizens have $1,000 of unspendable income. What has happened is that the government's spending of $1,000 out of newly created money has displaced $1,000 of spending by the citizens and has made $1,000 of the citizens' incomes back up on them as surplus unspendable funds. Observe how this phenomenon can grow progressively worse from year to year. We have just seen the government spend $1,000 and the citizens spend $9,000. This means that businesses have taken in a total of $10,000 in sales, and in the second year are again able to pay out $10,000 in incomes. But now these $10,000 of incomes are added on to $1,000 of surplus unspendable income from the year before. This year, therefore, the citizens would like to spend $11,000 rather than $10,000. They'd like to spend their $10,000 current income plus the $1,000 they weren't able to spend the year before. If the government again spends $1,000 out of newly created money, the citizens will again be able to succeed in spending no more than $9,000. Thus, there will now be an excess demand of $2,000. And in the third year, it will be $3,000, and so on. Observe how the shortages grow worse from year to year. It is not too long before people are ready to buy anything. This example, incidentally, helps to show why price controls do not create severe shortages in the very moment they are introduced. When the controls are first imposed, the existing prices are the proper prices. In fact, they may even have been raised somewhat in anticipation of the controls being imposed. It takes time for these prices to become outmoded, both by continuing inflation and by all the other forces acting to bring about changes in supply, demand, and cost. The longer the controls remain in force, the more serious their consequences become. because the more out of line do the controlled prices become in relation to the potential free market prices that would exist if the controls were repealed. This completes our discussion for this evening. Next week, we will consider the effects of universal price controls and universal shortages, and then begin an analysis of socialism. Thank you. All right, a question I've just received is, what would you do if you found yourself the tenant of a large, comfortable, but ridiculously rent-controlled apartment? Well, I would think that that would be practically impossible, because if it was controlled at a ridiculously low rent, why would the landlord have any incentive to maintain the apartment? If originally the apartment had had a doorman and was provided with various other services, those services were provided in order to bring in a certain rent. Well, if there are now 5,000 people willing to take that apartment, these services are no longer required as a condition of obtaining the tenants. So they would disappear. So I don't believe that there is the possibility of finding such a good bargain in a rent-controlled apartment. But if you asked, suppose I found myself in a rent-controlled apartment that, chintzy as it was, still represented some kind of bargain, well, I don't know what I would do. I don't think that it's immoral of anyone to live in a rent-controlled apartment, provided he is not trying to perpetuate the system. It's the same issue that Ayn Rand discusses in one of the essays, one of the articles in the Old Objectivist, I believe, or the Objectivist newsletter, dealing with the question of should people accept government scholarships? Well, only those who are opposed to them. So if you're opposed to rent control and you're doing whatever you can not to support the system but to eliminate it, then don't feel badly about living in a rent-controlled apartment. With the oil companies realizing their economic decline, do they attempt to invest money in lobbying to repeal the controls? Or do they not realize that the price controls are the crux of their problem? I am assuming that lobbying or even bribery might help in repealing price controls, since rational thinking does not seem to have any effect. Well, the oil companies are aware of their decline. They do spend a certain amount of money lobbying, and they do realize that price controls are a serious problem for them. But the kind of lobbying that they do is fruitless and ineffectual. They don't do any serious ideological work. And their attitude probably is that all that they have to do is be nice to their old friends in Congress. Now, maybe in the past, that consisted in large contributions, which if not outright bribery, might have been close to it. But in the present environment, to whatever extent they try that, it works against them. Because today, there is a very moralistic attitude in the wrong sense that if a business pays money to politicians so that they will not steal the property of the business is immoral. That's called bribery. And you see it in the case of AT&T in Chile, Lockheed dealing with various foreign governments. These governments have the companies in a terrible position. They can destroy them or grant favors as they wish. There's no other way to do business where governments have such power except by bribery. And the people who are complaining about it, who claim that they are such realists and naturalists, their view of human nature, if you judge from the novels and the plays, etc., that they support and rave about, their view of human nature is that it's a sewer, and here they create conditions in which people have to engage in bribery, and they get very upset about it and moralistic and claim how terrible this is. And then they support the Russians, who have a record of murder that defies description. These people are moral frauds. Are there any live questions? Yes? All right, there are two recently published books dealing with Russia which in many ways complement each other. One is the book I quoted from called, what did I call it, The Russians? The Russians. That's by Hedrick Smith. The other is called Russia by a man named Kaiser. I forget if it's Donald Kaiser or Robert Kaiser. The book by Kaiser, in many respects, is superior to the one by Smith. Kaiser has an excellent chapter on the failures of planning, on the overrated state of technology, the backward state of technology in Russia. Both of these books I highly recommend. They are both by newspaper reporters who have been stationed in Moscow. Smith was the head of the Times Bureau, and Kaiser was the correspondent for the Washington Post. That's very surprising to me because the books are both quite good. And I think it would make an interesting story, since these reporters knew these facts before, why has it taken so long for them to be published? I would suspect that there must have been pressures imposed by the editors against publishing books unfavorable to Russia. That might be one element. I seem to remember that in the 1950s, only 5% of U.S. oil consumption was imported. You mentioned that this figure is now 40%. Is this increase true? And if yes, is it entirely the result of price controls? The increase is definitely true. That's what it is. And it is the result of the combination of price controls plus all of the measures that I mentioned last week by which the government has acted to expand the demand for oil while restricting its supply. And I have a question here from last week. Someone asked me to repeat the six ways that the U.S. government has restricted the oil supply in the United States. So I'll answer that now. It's relevant to this question. Well, stopping or delaying the construction of the Alaska pipeline for many years. It's still not complete. Preventing the drilling for oil off the Atlantic seaboard. Holding up the construction or preventing the construction of new oil refineries and harbor facilities for handling supertankers. And of course, price controls. Repealing the depletion allowance on oil, which is a way of raising the taxes on the oil industry that reduces their profits and the capital they have available. And more recently, the threats of bringing arbitrary antitrust actions to break up integrated oil producers, those who have both refining operations and crude oil operations, and the outright threat of nationalization. These are factors that reduce investment and therefore hold down production. So the government has restricted domestic supply in all of these ways, and at the same time, as I mentioned last week, it has encouraged demand by having price controls on the natural gas industry, which undermined the growth of the natural gas industry. That stepped up the demand for oil. It's prohibited or prevented the development of atomic power plants, restricted coal mining. So this illustrates the demand overflow principle. The demand that would have been for atomic power plants and coal flows into an additional demand for oil. And the government, of course, made the auto manufacturers change the design of their engines for the sake of appeasing the ecologists, so they now require more gasoline per ton mile, and they made the electric utilities, in many cases, switch from coal to oil. Well, putting all these things together with price controls, that brings about a tremendous increase in imported oil. Would you repeat your explanation of why, after repeal of price controls on oil, the consumer's goods would increase less than factors of production, if I have this right, and how this would be taken away from the current revenues paid to the Arabs? What I said was, if we repealed the prices on domestically produced oil, the price of imported oil, which includes the price received by the Arabs, would tend to fall. So our domestic price of crude oil would rise, the Arab price would fall. The rise in the prices of consumer oil products would only take place to the extent that there was a rise in the average price of crude oil. Now observe, suppose our price, our crude oil, rose and Arab crude oil fell, and both to the same extent. In that case, there would be no rise in the prices of oil products paid by consumers. The rise in the price of domestic crude oil would be entirely financed by the fall in price of imported crude oil. Now, I explained that it would not work out fully that way. I explained that our oil would not rise simply to the present average price and the Arab oil fall to the present average price, because we start with imported oil at $13 a barrel, not only here in the United States, but throughout the world. The price of imported oil could not fall any more in the United States than it fell in the rest of the world. So the tendency toward a fall in imported oil prices here would be retarded by the fact that some oil that normally came here would be sent elsewhere. What would happen is our oil price would rise, the price of oil throughout the world received by foreign producers would drop. Yes? Are import quotas still in existence? In earlier years, back in the 50s and 60s, and this was a factor I forgot to mention, the United States domestic production was so strong that the oil companies wanted the government to actually keep out imported oil. And the government had policies which deliberately restricted the importation of foreign oil. They were called import quotas because the government would allow each foreign country to just send so much oil to the United States. Now, what happened in the late 60s was, as the government's policies restricting natural gas, preventing additional oil production domestically, as these policies came into effect, the government repealed the import quotas. And in this way, we were able to make up for the decline in domestic production, or the slowing down in the growth of domestic production, with additional imports. The fact that we had import quotas and repealed them is what prevented the price of oil from rising sooner. Yes, sir? In the back on the left. Pardon me? You asked me if I believe the price of oil will go higher. I don't hear you. England made a study that oil will go much higher in the US. I would expect that oil should go higher and higher because inflation will continue and because the government is continuing to undermine our own domestic oil industry, enabling the Arab cartel to take greater and greater advantage of us. Now, a question reads, I have more than once seen rising interest rates cited as a cause, not a consequence of inflation, in the sense of raising overall price levels. Is this merely a variant of the cost push doctrine, or are there special features to be noted? Well, I would say that this is a variant of the cost push doctrine, the idea that rising interest rates raise prices, but the fact is that the causation is entirely the other way. It is an expanding quantity of money and a rising aggregate demand that raises nominal profits, and then the rise in nominal profits raises nominal interest rates. It would not be possible to have interest rates at 7, 8, or 10% if spending and prices in the economy were not rising very, very rapidly. Please keep in mind that interest is paid for the most part out of profits. In order to pay 10% interest rates, you need profit rates that are at least 10% or better. Well, what is it that makes profit rates so high? It's the fact that the quantity of money expands, and think back to the example I gave you last week in the handout, how nominal profit rates are increased. That helps to raise interest rates. The fact also that prices rise is taken into account by lenders. If prices are going to rise 10% a year, well, to the extent that you anticipate this, it's foolish to make a loan at any rate of interest less than 10%, because if you do, you're losing in real terms. So it is not rising interest rates that raise prices. It's an expanding quantity of money that raises prices, profits, and the rate of interest. Yes, sir? Well, let me ask you to save that question either for next week or lecture 9 when we get into universal controls, okay? Yes? What is the effect of the cooperation that they give? And you're asking, what is the effect of American companies whose properties have been nationalized by the Arabs, nevertheless working in some capacity, providing technical assistance to the Arab oil industry? Well, as far as they do anything that enables the Arabs to produce more oil, that means that there is somewhat more oil in the world and the price is therefore somewhat lower. Now, the problem is, you might ask, why are these companies doing it after they've been expropriated? Well, they may take the attitude that they've been robbed, but they'll at least get a few percent back by continuing to work. Now I have a question. What, if any, are the reciprocal effects of a free market and a controlled one? For example, the United States is relatively free versus Russia completely controlled. Is the free market harmed? Is the controlled market benefited? Well, the controlled economy is very definitely benefited. They would starve to death without the free economy. Just consider what would happen to Russia if there were no United States and Canada and Australia from which to buy wheat. Well, a few famines, and that is the end of Russia. So they very definitely need us. They have nothing without us. If not for the Western world, taking the countries I've mentioned plus Western Europe, the living conditions, even of the top commissars, would be very, very primitive. If you read these books that I've recommended on Russia, you'll see that something that is considered an enormous status symbol, people think they have really arrived in nirvana, is when they have an apartment in Russia that is furnished with furniture from an American department store. which they're able to do because they travel on diplomatic missions and so on. If you take away the Western goods, the Western refrigerators, washing machines, etc., if you took away key Western imports, the standard of living of the top Russian officials might resemble that of primitive Indian Maharajas. They would live better than their average subjects. They'd have some rubies in their belly buttons or whatever, but they would not have a modern standard of living. Now, is the free market harmed? Well, to the extent that we give them things for free, yes, we have a loss. Otherwise, I would say one couldn't claim that we're definitely harmed. We wouldn't give them very much if the government did not provide the credit, if the government did not guarantee the loans. Because remember, the policy of the communist countries is to steal whatever money is invested in them. They don't pay their debts. So a few people might invest, they would lose, then they would have a bad credit rating, and the investment would stop. People would only do business with them on a strictly cash basis. Well, the government is what permits them to obtain continuous credit. Yes, Mr. Schwartz? Do non-Arab countries other than the United States have price controls on their domestically produced oil? I'm not in a position to say categorically. There are some countries which I believe do not have any price controls on oil. I don't know, I don't believe that Canada has any price controls.
And the Arabs maintain
a $30 price in those countries? The international price of oil is the same everywhere. If the price were any lower in some countries than other countries, then the oil would not be sent to the lower priced countries. It would be sent to the higher priced countries, which would act to equalize their prices. You see, during the oil crisis, we were controlling even imported oil below the world market. So that was a factor which stopped us from getting imported oil. Now at least we have no control on imported oil, which is why there are no waiting lines today. Yes, sir? Well, it has been credits, and there are several books. There's a series of books, I believe, called Soviet Russia and Western Economic Development, I think maybe the title. The whole set had been sold through the Ayn Rand Letter and before that the Objectivist Book Service. The series is by Anthony Sutton at the Hoover Institute in California. And he would give you a detailed answer on that question. I know that for their entire history, under the communists and even before the communists, the Russians have been chronic borrowers of foreign technology. And not just the technology, the physical capital goods. And without it, this goes back in the communist case to the 1920s and the 30s, many, many of their factories were built by foreign companies. And as far as I know, they were built on credits either at the expense of the companies or at the expense of the governments of the respective countries. The effect has been a loss to the countries, to the foreign countries who provided the investments. Now I have a question from a couple of weeks back. Could you comment on the effect of government control of alien labor and give your view of the present restrictive legislation? This is a question, in effect, asking what do I think of immigration laws? Well, I would have to say that immigration laws are a violation of the natural rights of the individual, that if anyone has the fare to come to a country, can find a job and rent a place to live, there is no basis on which anyone else has the right to stop him. The proper relations are strictly between individuals. So if an Englishman or a Mexican or whomever finds an American employer who wants to hire him, an American landlord who will rent him an apartment, a steamship company or airline to sell him a ticket, that's all there should be to it. Now, observe, I'm not talking at all about people who would come to be on welfare. I'm talking about people who would pay their own way and work and support themselves. Now, if one asks, what would be the economic effects of free immigration? Well, I think that the long-run economic effects would be to raise the general standard of living for the native population. Now, the immediate effect would be, if more people start coming in, money wage rates tend to fall because there is more competition in the labor market. But then you have to realize more goods are being produced, so prices also fall. Now, people may worry, what is the effect of increasing the amount of labor in relation to the amount of capital? Well, as soon as you admit that more goods are produced, more capital goods are being produced too. So in a short time, there is no reason why the ratio of capital to labor should be diminished. The long-run effect would be that a larger population would make possible a greater division of labor. We could produce things on a bigger scale. We could have more specialized machinery used in many cases. This reduces costs per unit. If you ask why is it that the American standard of living is higher than the standard of living, say, in France or West Germany, the reason is the fact that we have a larger market. We have a market of 200 million people without internal trade restrictions. The markets in those countries are much smaller. Our automobile companies, for example, can produce for a market of 200 million people at a lower cost than their automobile companies can produce for their smaller markets in real terms. Well, if we had a bigger population, we could have more division of labor and therefore lower costs. Now, I would have to say, to give a complete answer, that for a somewhat longer time, while the average standard of living in the country would be rising, the standard of living at the low end of the scale might lag. What would happen is the standard of living of the middle class would rise especially. The standard of living of the lower paid element of the domestic population would lag more because the influx of labor, the weight of the influx would be at the unskilled level. People coming in who don't speak the language would be concentrated in the unskilled areas. So there'd be perhaps a tendency for a time for the wages of unskilled workers to lag behind the general improvement, the wages of skilled workers and professional workers to be much greater. Yes? Are you asking, do I think it would be justified for the government to interfere in a deal between a private grain company and the Russian government? And you're raising a case in which it's a deal that the grain company wants to make. It's not a credit operation or anything of that type. Then I would have to say no, that the government would not have a right. But now, suppose you raise the question, would the government have a right to intervene if the Russian government were going to buy a fleet of bombers from an aircraft company? Then I would say yes. You could raise the argument that the company would be an accessory to a possible crime. Any further questions from the floor? All right, I'll take one. Yes?
I'm not sure why a abolition of
Right. Why would the abolition of price controls on domestic oil reduce the price of OPEC oil? Okay, I'm glad you asked. So let's go through that again. At the present time, domestic oil is controlled at $7.66 a barrel. OPEC oil, that's the Arab cartel oil, is uncontrolled at $13 a barrel. The weighted average of these two prices is $9.80 a barrel. If you take $7.66 times 60% and $13 times 40%, which are the proportions that they have in the domestic supply, you come out with $9.80. Now, $9.80 is the basis on which the price of gasoline, heating oil, etc., is controlled. Now, think what would happen if the domestic oil were freed of controls, and assume for the moment that the price of domestic oil rose to $13. I want to show why this could not be the case, why it would not be possible for domestic oil to rise to $13 along with the Arab oil, by the implications of what would happen if it did. So if it did, think what would be the cost, the average cost of a barrel of crude oil, if both domestic oil and Arab oil were selling at 13 a barrel. The average would then be 13 a barrel, right? What would have to happen to the prices of oil products? They'd have to be higher. What would happen to the quantities of oil products that could be sold at higher prices? They'd have to be lower. What would happen to the quantity of crude oil that could be sold in that case? That would be lower.
The assumption is that the weighted average that oil now sells in this country is a free market price.
Well, the question is the assumption that the weighted average at which oil now sells in this country is a free market price? In some respects, not fully, because what makes it, let me give you a respect in which it obviously isn't, the average price. Wait, that will involve unnecessary complication. Let me say that because we do not control imported oil, we have avoided continuing the oil crisis. If we controlled imported oil, the waiting lines would be back. But to go to your original question, simply think, if you realize that an average of $13 a barrel for crude oil would prevent the present quantity of crude oil from being sold, well, ask yourself, what would be required to continue the sale of the present quantity of crude oil? What would be required to make it possible for the Arabs to continue to sell the present quantity of crude oil that they now sell in the United States? Well, the prices of oil products would have to be the same as they now are. The average cost of crude oil would have to be the same as it now is. That's $9.80 a barrel. But the price of domestic oil would be $9.80. So what would have to be implied about the price of Arab oil? It would have to be $9.80. Now, the only thing that would prevent Arab oil from being reduced all the way to $9.80 and our oil merely rising to $9.80 is the fact that the Arabs have other places in the world to sell besides here. So as the price here started to fall from $13 toward $9.80, they would send less oil here and more oil to other countries. So what would happen is the average would come to rest at some point above the present $9.80. But it would have to be below 13. So that is why the Arabs would have to sell at a lower price. And I think we can wrap up the discussion for this evening. Next week, we'll go into universal controls. Thank you.